Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
From Variety, celebrating more than 115 years covering the business of entertainment, this is the Award Circuit Podcast.
To touch one person who left something like buried inside and to relieve that person from that, even just for the time that they're just watching my film. I'm not talking about forever. I'm not talking about changing their lives. I'm just talking about this 1 hour and 40 minutes where they're watching my film. If they feel less alone with something, then I think that, I mean, that's the best thing that can happen.
French director Julia Ducournau, who burst onto the world filmmaking scene in 2016 with her first feature, Raw, is back with another major work of art in her new film, Titan. I'm Michael Schneider, and on this edition of the Variety Awards Circuit Podcast, we talk to Julia Ducournau about the journey to creating her film, Titan, and her struggle to connect with the main character. But first, our Awards Circuit Roundtable discusses West Side Story, Don't Look Up, and the upcoming Critics' Choice and Golden Globe nominations. It's all on this edition of the Variety Awards Circuit Podcast. Stay close. It's Roundtable time. Happy holidays, everyone. Clayton Davis.
Ho, Michael ho, ho. Schneider. Good to see you. Don't call me a ho. But yes, I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm good. I think I've just been canceled, though, by Clayton Davis.
Live on air.
Yeah, live on air.
Whatever.
Janelle Riley, how's it going?
You can call me anything you want, Body Mike.
That's you're keeping that nickname going. Someone needs to. And Jazz Tankay, taking a break from her 100 panels this week. Well, all three of you. Ridiculous, the amount of work you're all doing right now.
Yeah, it's like there's not a pandemic anymore.
Exactly. I know where Janelle is at all times.
Oh, because of Instagram? But not me posting, but a friend of yours who, yeah, it comes to a lot of my panels.
Oh, that's right. You all have stalkers. I forget. You all have your personal fan clubs.
No, they're very nice.
But yeah, it's busy times, including events. It's like 2019 all over again, folks.
Right?
Like, we're mm-hmm. out and
careful
out
what
and
you
about.
Wish for. It's like last year I was like, oh man, I miss in-person events, and now I mean I still love it, but like, yeah, there's a couple times where you're just like, oh, I miss my bed.
Now it's like you're scheduling. Like, how can I get from the Four Seasons to the London in like 10 minutes?
I have one tonight. I got to get from one location to another pretty quickly. And I'm like trying to strategize traffic.
Yeah. Like getting like the car out yep. of the parking lot first.
That's
like the academy.
Exactly yeah. it. That's exactly it. But the it's so funny because you can never strategize traffic in LA. Like, no. Don't even try. And yet I think if I, you know, check every night, three nights before, I'll get a reasonable estimate.
And just to talk about, I know you have a watch, obviously, to keep an eye on the time.
Yes.
So I figured I'd be really smart and get an Apple Watch and like set the alarm on silent. So if you do that, or if you put your phone on silent and you set the alarm to vibrate, the only problem is you're literally sitting in your panel vibrating. Yep. So your wrist is vibrating and your pocket is vibrating. You're like, that does not work.
Well, as an old... my eyesight is not great, and so I had to get this giant watch with a big face that has big numbers on it, and you can, like, really see it in the photos. Like, it's this big, clunky thing, and it's cheap. It's, like, $6 from Rite Aid. Very hard to find a watch under $60 in Los Angeles, and I can't spend money on watches because they break really easily on me. And, you know, sometimes they don't come with instructions. And during the Power of the Dog panel the other night, like, Benedict Cumberbatch was saying something really profound, and my stupid watch started beeping. And I was like, we're just going to pretend this isn't happening. So.
This is the oldest millennial conversation I've ever heard. Like, in the history of ever. Like, instructions on watches. I don't wear watches because I don't like them.
I don't like them either. Yeah. I only get it for a Q&A.
They mess up my balance.
Yeah, but we've all been there where you're on stage and you're moderating a panel and you sort of have to figure out the subtle way to look at your watch or look at the time without it appearing like you're looking at the time. And it's creative ways to pull that off.
I can't wear like real watches because there's like something in my body chemistry. It just breaks watches. They never last more than 3 months.
It's your body rejecting any chemicals it's trying to give you.
There's a name for it, and it's actually fairly common, I've learned. It's like some sort of like an electrical current that certain people have, and electronics tend to fail on them.
No. For me, Magneto. It pulls my Magneto. it pulls my wrist hair.
Okay, there's that.
That's why I always hate when we go to like events and they put the wristbands. And
I hate those things.
And it tapes on my hair. I'm like, stop.
All right, this is a scintillating conversation.
Everyone. I know, yeah. But, it's tantalizing.
I'm finally pulling the producer card and saying, guys, let's get back on topic. Let's hone it in. So speaking of events, so Clayton and Jazz, tell me about where you were last night, Monday night.
Time of recording. We went to the celebration of Black Cinema to celebrate Black Cinema and TV, rather, where it was hosted by Niecy Nash, who is just funny as can be, as always. And the room, so I'm sure we all feel this way. As we have gotten to this new stage of the pandemic and there are in-person events, there's just been a lot of love in a room. Like journalists never hugged each other, and people hug me so much now, and it's a good change. I don't mind like a good hug, but everyone just seems really, really, because I think because we know we're vaccinated, you have to be vaccinated, you have to be tested right before you go, all those things. So I think people are just really, really happy to be with people again. And a lot of that you can feel through the evening. But Ava DuVernay got the first ever Melvin Van Peebles Trailblazer Award, which was presented to her by Mario Van Peebles, which, by the way, they gave out his dad's Criterion package collection. It was on every seat for a guest to take after the event, which was fun. Yeah.
That was an amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a nice little swag.
Barry Jenkins gave one of the best. Well, no, actually, he did give one of the best speeches. It was presented to him. His award was presented to him by his editor, Joy McMillan, and he gave us such a beautiful shout out, which was so nice to see because, you know, more often than not, covering it, artisans don't always get a lot of accolade, and she presented it to him, and she is the funniest person.
Yeah, she should have a stand-up act. She's really funny.
If you've ever interviewed her, like, you will sit there, like, in hysterics because she's, like, the funniest person. But, yeah, he gave her a really nice shout-out, and that was sweet. But I think Halle Berry definitely gave the most emotional speech of the evening.
Yeah.
And Clayton videoed it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I videoed a lot of them. Barry Jenkins, by the way, gave me a shout out too.
He thanked
Clayton Davis, and then I, you know, now I'm hiring publicity now because that makes me really famous if they say your name on stage. So there's that. Halle brought the house down. She got the Career Achievement Award. I mean, listen, she's standing up there. She was like, you know, I'm standing up here as a director. I've been in a lot of rooms that look like this. You know, Will Smith got the Actor Award. He's not there because Emancipation won't stop shooting ever. He's in Avatar 2, 3, 4 level now. Like, Emancipation is that movie that will never stop. Antoine Fuqua was also not there. Got the Director Award for The Guilty. The cast of The Harder They Fall got the Ensemble Prize. Dion Cole gave a very, very funny speech. I need a Dion Cole Oscar host, I think. Yeah. I think that's where I am now. I think he should host the Oscars. Mike, I did ask him, by the way, on the red carpet, when we're getting a Dion Cole stand-up special, and he said soon, 2022. So I got some cool interviews on the carpet there.
That's cool. Which was good,
because he is Dion hilarious. Ruth Negga got a great award. Danielle Brooks from Mahalia. Gave a really, really beautiful speech. And Jennifer Hudson gave a really good good shout out because she's there for respect, and also asked her on the red carpet about, you know, if she's going to be doing a talk show, because rumor, word on the street. And she says she does
more
like
than word on the street. That was in variety.com. <Yeah. laughs>
You can't trust that source.
Yeah. Yeah. She said her life goes through different, I think she said like her life goes through different times, and she does like to talk, but she did talk about getting back into music, and she's going to get back into the studio, which was really cool and interesting. And Robin Thede's my spirit animal. I want to hang out with her for the rest of my life.
She's the best.
Love, love.
She is great.
She is fantastic. Well, while you were partying over there, I was at the dress rehearsal for Live in front of a studio audience,
wow.
The Facts of Life and Different Yay. Strokes. And I will say this, perfect casting, Kevin Hart as Arnold Drummond. And you'll see that the second you see him standing. So Kevin Hart is 5'4". John Lithgow, who plays Mr. Drummond, is 6'4". So when you see the two of them standing next to each other, yeah, it works. There's a point where John Lithgow picks up Kevin Hart like he's a kid. There's a point where Kevin Hart jumps into John Lithgow's lap like he's an 8-year-old. That's the moment that brought down the house. But Ann Dowd as Mrs. Garrett is fantastic. Close your eyes, you
really?
Think it actually is Charlotte Ray. The wig was on point, the vocal inflections. It's so much fun. So by the time people are listening to this, they've already watched it, and I hope they enjoyed it, especially some of the cameos that show up. Snoop Dogg shows up. You've got Will Arnett and Jason Bateman, Jon Stewart, and then also bringing down the house, couple of the original cast members.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Including Lisa Welchel, Blair, who sings the opening to The Facts of Life.
Oh, that's
she
so
opens
cool.
the entire show singing, and Lisa Welchel, look, I mean, how is she? She has not aged. She
wow.
looks incredible. She still looks like Blair, and she was even wearing the Eastland girl school outfit as Blair. It's probably her original costume. It still fits. She looks incredible. So a really, really fun show. We'll always love those, and they always win Emmys, and I'm sure this one probably will again too.
I just remembered my favorite like Facts of Life joke is in Inside Amy Schumer when she did 12 Angry Men parody, and someone said something, and Kumail Nanjiani was like, you can't take Joe. Joe would break you in half. And I always found that to be very, very funny. By the way, I do need to mention, because this I realize this is airing after the fact, Celebration of Latino Cinema is happening Thursday. And that would have happened by then, where honorees Reynaldo Marcus Green, Clifton Collins Jr., Olga Merediz were all in attendance, and hosted by Cristela Alonso, who is also a very funny individual and should pursue a career in comedy.
Love Cristela too, and her show is now, I think, streaming on her Cristela comedy. I think it's now streaming on Hulu, if I'm not mistaken, or somewhere. So do go back and watch that. So what's going on this weekend, kids? What's opening? What are people hitting the theaters to see?
A movie called West Side Story,
little indie film. As Rachel Zegler said at our Q&A the other night. Her first job was in a little indie film by Steven Spielberg called West Side Story.
How is that her first film?
Her first professional acting job. It's ridiculous.
That's amazing.
It's a good year for like brand newcomers between Alana Haim and Rachel Zegler. And also, probably my favorite story from West Side Story, from the casting, is David Alvarez won a Tony when I think he was 15 for playing one of the Billy Elliots on Broadway. And then he left acting, joined the Army, was backpacking around Mexico, he's had a 3-year backpacking trip, and got the call to audition for the role of Bernardo. And wasn't even sure he wanted to get back into acting, but now he's back. He loves it. He's going to keep doing it. And I'm so glad because he's fantastic.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And Rita Moreno singing Somewhere. I mean,
how do you feel it's going to do this weekend?
I think, and it's probably the variant doing its thing, maybe like, sadly, its best friend, because I think it's going to make like $4.
Really?
Because I think anyone that would have gone to see this isn't going to the movies right now. And but it won't matter. I'm also one that doesn't think box office really matters anymore. Like,
oh,
I think
no, I agree.
I think we need to just like kind of get off, like, you know, it's a bomb. Like, it would be like if we were still judging album sales like they were in the 90s. Like, I just feel like it just isn't, like, and we say Adele bombed. She had 800,000 copies, you know.
Well, it's the same thing in TV with ratings. So now that everything does a 0.6 rating, you can't really judge things by that anymore. It's got to be the long tail. It's got to be the impact in other ancillary markets.
Yeah.
It's the impact in terms of pop culture. It's a lot tougher. You're right now. So,
Michael, Mr. Nielsen would like a word with you.
Ooh.
Mr. Nielsen is dead, as are the Nielsen ratings. Hot take.
I mean, it's true, though. The ratings just, like, you can't judge it the same way any longer. But it won't matter for West Side Story if it makes $4 or not. It's going to, like, I was at the first LA SAG Q&A that was hosted by someone on this podcast named Janelle Riley.
I didn't invite them all. I just moderated the conversation.
She moderated after. I, you know, the room blew
crazy.
Up.
It
blew
crazy.
Up.
Crazy.
They stood up. Like,
for every single cast member. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's loved out there. Now, is it a Best Picture winner? I don't know. We can see kind of how we go down the line with that. But I did see it, you know, which was the first step in this quest of knowing what West Side Story was about. And I just have to say, Ariana DeBose, I wish we weren't having a conversation in which we are just hoping you get into a supporting actress 5. I wish we were having a conversation that it would be a no-brainer that you would be winning the category.
I feel like it's a no-brainer she's getting in, don't you?
Yeah.
No?
No.
It's hard. It's hard to say. It is a competitive category.
There are 20. I'm not even like exaggerating. There are 20 women.
And weirdly, they're all in Belfast.
Yeah. I mean, listen, the fact that Meryl Streep is like number 12 shows you how deep this category is.
Good point.
She's 12.
I was thinking about that this morning. I was like, because they had the Don't Look Up premiere the other night in New York, and it was like, this is such a strange year where the Meryl Streep slot is not a guarantee. Like,
nope.
She's like way down, which.
Nope. Regina King is like 18 and she's great in Harder They Fall. Like, I mean, everyone is just like fighting for 5 spots.
Don't Look Up also opens this weekend, technically, in theaters before, you know, hitting Netflix in a couple weeks. Yeah.
I think, listen, also lead actor. Very competitive because Leo's fighting for a spot, and like, I don't know if he's gonna get one.
I feel pretty bullish about that. I think he gets in, but you're right. I mean, nothing is for sure.
Yeah.
And by the way, our podcast guest this week is Adam McKay,
director.
He allows me to say that Leo looks a little schlubby in this movie because I was like, he's playing against type. I was like, I don't want to say he looks schlubby, but he looks like, you know, like normal. And Adam realized like, he's a little schlubby. You can say schlubby. Like that was the idea, you know, and it's just really fun to see him play so against type.
What do we think about the so much of the narrative right now about Adam McKay being all about the falling out with Will Ferrell? And that's so much of what the focus has been on the past couple of days.
I might be naive.
Weeks.
I honestly feel like that's like a subset.
I think it's inside baseball.
Yeah,
I don't think anyone really knows like anything about it.
Yeah, and they're from like everything I've experienced or people I've talked to, they're both just such nice guys. It's like, it's just sort of a shame, you know, sometimes that these things happen. And honestly, I hope they work it out because, look, I went to see Nightmare Alley and all I could think about was Mary Steenburgen and Richard Jenkins are both in this movie and they don't have a scene together. Where's my stepbrother's reunion?
Yep.
So I want out of life is a stepbrother's reunion.
I was thinking that with Rooney Mara and Cate Blanchett. I was like,
yes!
Really? That's all we're going to get? Come on. Where's the camera?
I mean, at least they were in the same room.
Yeah.
But But I interviewed Guillermo last week, and I was like, Guillermo, like, I love your movie, but I'm going to tell you you're kind of a piece of crap because you have Richard Jenkins and Mary Steenburgen, and you don't even like flirt with them engaging for a second. And he was like, I heard that afterwards, and it didn't like dawn on me. I was like, well, come on, I need you to be that visionary filmmaker we know you to be.
Director's then, cut.
Yeah.
Director's cut. Cute. Yeah.
Like reshoots, man. Bring them back.
And their characters do know each other. Because he's friends with her husband, so it makes perfect sense.
They could have. Yes. It's fine. And then this weekend. And Don't Look Up. Do you think there's supporting play there for which one? I guess that's.
I think it goes several directions. I would not rule out Mark Rylance, who is very funny and weird and obviously a beloved, respected actor. I'm not ruling out Meryl.
I was talking about supporting actor.
Supporting actor. Yeah, I lean towards Mark Rylance. Jonah Hill is very, very good and funny. But I don't know that, you know, there's so many good people in it that, you know, I don't know how many people get the most screen time. But I, like I said, I'm not ruling anything out at this point.
Yeah. I think this is his best. This is McKay's best of his like serious outings, like outside of Step Brothers, Other Guys, which I love also, by the way. But I think your mileage on supporting actor will be your mileage with the movie in a weird way. Like for the first 40 minutes, I was laughing a lot, and then the movie gets very real, and then you're like, "Oh, this sucks because this is tomorrow." Like, this is our life.
More like yesterday.
Yeah.
It's
like,
so prescient.
It becomes a real bummer. In a good, like, not that, like, it's, like, in a bad way. Like, you're just like, damn, this sucks. So what happens is when Jonah Hill comes in later again, you're like, oh, no, F you, dude. Like, I know you. You're someone that exists right now. So, but Mark Rylance is also like, oh, hi, Mark Zuckerberg, soon.
Well, I think like, he's more Steve Jobs. With the,
I don't know that he had Meta written all over his face. Yeah, if you ask me.
It is like a funny amalgam of
he's all of them.
Yeah, he really is. It's a nice blend.
Oh, Swan Song opens this week too, right?
Oh, that's right.
Can we just give a little shout out to that?
I love you, Mahershala.
Mahershala Ali, so good in that movie, in dual roles, was our guest on the podcast last week.
Yeah.
Got him to talk a little bit about Blade. And if you need just something soothing, just listen to his voice for that 30-minute interview. He's got the best voice. Oh, and something that I thought was interesting is he's allergic to dogs. And his character in Swan Song, you know, is very close with a dog and at one point is even holding a dog. And, you know, they had to maneuver around that because he is horribly, horribly allergic.
Wow.
So now we definitely know that Janelle Riley, Mahershala Ali would never work out.
Oh, like, that's ever. Right.
It would never.
I'm a dog. I'm a dog person. Yes, that's the reason.
That's the reason.
The Mahershala clone, maybe.
Yeah.
That's clone enough Mahershalas to go around.
This is, I know everyone's joking, but for years it feels like people have been trying to set me up with Mahershala Ali. And while I'm very flattered, he is way out of my league.
Well, real quick, let's look ahead to Monday, because Monday is big nomination day. Critics' Choice Film. And then Golden Globes.
It's announcing at the same time? Or
3 hours apart.
Okay.
But they are announcing on Monday, so we'll see what that looks like, how it goes, what we're talking about.
Turn down their nominations?
So there are no submissions.
Right.
So anyone can just be. So I guess you can. I guess in theory you could be like, I refuse to be nominated, but your name is still there. I don't think it works like Grammy stuff,
right? Which just happened this week.
Yeah,
someone
with Drake. So they can just nominate whatever they want. And listen, like, you know, we know that there's like, you know, back, you know, door campaigning happening. So people are going to pop in here and there. I think it's going to be, for me, I'm interested a little bit in the, and I'm, by the time this is out, it probably won't be out. I'll have like some thoughts, but the genre things that we usually run into there, the genre questions, like, what's House of Gucci? What's Being the Ricardos? What's Licorice Pizza? You know, what's another big one that I had a question on? Yeah, like those are interesting, like little bit. Eyes of Tammy Faye, another one. Like, are those comedies or those dramas? So that's what I'll be a little bit interested in. But other than that, it'll be whatever it ends up being.
Yeah, especially with no submission process.
Yeah.
It's really up for the Globes to decide, I guess.
And international can now be in picture. So I just feel like all the and animated back as well. I just feel like all these like problems that they've had the last few years, they'll make a point to make a statement in a couple areas. So I wouldn't be surprised if, like, Parallel Mothers is in Best Picture drama. Like, mm-hmm. that seems like what they'll do, or a hero. And then they'll nominate some acting foreign performances or something like that. But I am almost feeling certain that Ben Affleck is going to be there. I just don't know what for.
Oh, you mean between Tender Bar and Last Duel? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or both. I'm looking for my Tom Cruise Tropic Thunder nomination.
He's so wonderful in both movies. He really is. He's so lovely in Tender Bar, but I just think his performance in Last Duel is such a scene stealer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the TV side, I'm not really expecting anything too wild or outlandish. I think
he didn't even like, he's like, nah, not really.
Gonna go out on a limb with that one?
I'm kind of, eh. Critics' Choice TV came out. Some interesting choices real quick. They love Evil.
I love Evil. If Evil were on HBO, it would be sweeping awards. It is so clever, dark, funny, original. Like, I just love how crazy that show is.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Kings. The Kings, they know TV. So, you know, congrats to them and Paramount Plus for, you know, getting on the board.
Yeah. I was on the NomCom this year for TV, and Evil was like, oh, like, a lot of times people like really go hard. It's kind of like New York Film Critics Circle when they announce winners. Like, people walk in with like some packs of like, all right, we have to put our eggs into this basket to make sure this happens.
Well, I loved For All Mankind getting a drama nod, because it's such a good show, and it's, you know, it's people, you know, critics are talking about it, but I think it still doesn't get the kind of buzz that it should get. And then, you know, Squid Game's going to Squid Game. It's everywhere. So,
oh, Squid.
But
actually, Mike, I have a question for you with, because SAG voting also opened this past Monday.
Yeah.
Are you feeling the Squid Game taking ensemble?
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
Like that. I mean,
definitely get a nomination, and then we'll see. Sort of, you know, have people already moved on? Is the nomination going to be the big win? But at the very least, it absolutely gets a drama ensemble nomination this year.
What's its biggest competition?
Succession,
of course. Yeah. Succession, which has never been nominated for a SAG award,
right? Yes. Which honestly, that's right. Why I think Succession it probably will get the leg up, only because we've kind of moved on a little bit from Squid Game, and we're like knee deep in Succession, and now,
yeah,
I mean. Did you guys all watch Sunday's episode?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we can't spoil it for Clayton, but it ends on quite a note. And by the way, I'm talking to Sarah Snook. And by the time this podcast comes out, that podcast will have already posted, along with your chat, you know, with Nicholas Bertel. So we've got a Succession twofer that is in your inbox. If you haven't listened to it yet, hopefully Sarah will chat a little bit about all the things that went on. For a number of characters on the penultimate episode. Shit's going down. Is going down.
Yeah.
Wait, hold on, Mike. I have like two more questions for you, because we don't get to talk TV with you a lot, so this is very interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think only Murders in the Building gets ensemble? Because sometimes you interpret that as just three people, and they like larger ensembles, even though there are five. Do you think it misses?
I think people love Steve Martin and Martin Short so much that it's that still could yeah, kind of win out over. You're right. It does feel like it's a three-hander. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
Nathan Lane.
Yeah, I mean, Nathan, he's just not in every episode, so
what
you don't
Sting?
Think of him.
Yeah. Sting could be a SAG Award nominee.
I don't think Sting would be a part of that mix.
Yeah, but. Actually, I don't think Nathan would get an ensemble nomination. I think the other two would be Aaron Dominguez and Amy Ryan.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think they're the only two that would end up getting it.
Still
great. If they were included. Because I remember, I went back to our history, Million Dollar Baby that year was only Clint Eastwood, Morgan Freeman, and Hilary Swank.
And won.
No, it lost.
Did it lose to Sideways?
It lost. Yeah, Sideways won that.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. I remember now.
And then Beast of No Nation also had three people in their ensemble when it was nominated. So they have done it. All right. So that was that one. And then lastly, Mike, for you, Ted Lasso. Do you think the second season does what it's been doing? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think it absolutely gets the nomination, and it's still the front runner.
Okay.
Because don't forget, this is SAG. It's like that, you know, 25,000? No, 125,000, right?
It goes out to everyone. The radio people.
Yeah. So I think when you're dealing with that kind of a large body, you know, there's still a huge chunk that, you know, hasn't been jaded by the backlash to Ted Lasso. And I think Ted Lasso ended up sort of, you know, really, you know, ended on a strong note, and it'll forever be the front runner this year. We'll see beyond that. But I think it still is like in line definitely for a nomination, let alone probably for the win.
Small ensembles, I think. Also, I was thinking about Hacks for that too. Like,
do you
see that it's just like Smart and Einbender, and then Carl Clemens, I guess, as well. Like, what do you kind of do in that realm? So, it'd be interesting to see if it gets into ensemble.
I hope it does.
I want to listen, SAG. If you're listening, all SAG, because I know you listen to this every week. Girls Five Eva.
Oh,
Girls
so
Five
good.
Eva.
So good.
That.
I had a dream last night about Girls Five Eva. That's funny.
That's a wonderful dream, and you should dream it all the time.
I had my Girls Five Eva pants on.
When is it back?
Not soon enough is the answer. But I don't think they've announced that yet. All right. Well, on that note, gang, we should get going, and we'll have a lot to talk about next week once more nominations come out and more stuff happens. So until then.
Oh, also a guest this week, Julia DeCornow, Titan. I can't say it right. It's a Neon podcast this week.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
After the break, Titan director Julia Ducournau. From Los Angeles, this is Variety's Award Circuit Podcast.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we're back. It's the Award Circuit Podcast. I'm Michael Schneider. French director Julia Ducournau is changing the vocabulary of cinema with her heart-stopping imagery and boundary-blurring approach to genre. That originality helped propel her second film, Titan, to a Palme d'Or win in Cannes this year, making Ducournau just the second woman to win the prestigious prize after Jane Campion. Titan is the story of a young woman who has a metal plate fitted in her skull after a terrible accident as a child. On the run after a series of violent encounters, she finds refuge at a fire station and a father figure in a fire chief, played by veteran French star Vincent Lindon. All the while, her body feels the transformative and visceral effects of having coupled with a shiny, sexy automobile at a car show.
Tu connais la Macarena? On va chanter la Macarena tous les deux, d'accord? Et tu vas me suivre en rythme et tu presses toutes tes forces, d'accord? Ta 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 Macarena, ta 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 Cosa buena, ta 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 Macarena, oh Macarena, souffle, souffle si elle meurt, souffle. On recommence. Ta 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 Macarena, ta 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 Cosa buena, ta 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 Macarena, oh Macarena. Allez.
Variety's Clayton Davis spoke with Ducournau about Titane, and they began by discussing how she prepared for the process of constructing a script for the film.
Well, the first thing that I can say is that it was not easy at all. I think that Titane is the hardest script I've ever had to write, although I'm very young in my career. But I think that I never struggled as much as I did for this one for many reasons. The first reason, obviously, is, and somehow I want to say a very important one, but also a very side one somehow, because it comes from the outside. I was very scared of the expectations that people had for my second film, knowing that Raw had found its own success. And I was like aware that people were expecting things, which was not the case, obviously. When it's your first feature, no one expects anything because no one even knows you exist. So this is something that I struggled with very much. I also struggled with my own expectations as far as my second film was concerned. When I came out of Titane, I was very drained, and I gave everything I had to Out of Raw. And I felt that I had given everything I had to Raw, and I was afraid that I didn't have anything else to give to another film, and especially Love. And so that was something that took a long time to find in me, you know, not to compare a film that does not exist yet to a film that is finished. And this is something that can be quite crippling. And the last thing is that once I got to surpass my writer's block, which lasted a very long time, it lasted for a year, and I got to the story and to Alexia, I found another obstacle, which was the fact that I could not relate to my main character. And I could not relate to my main character because no one can. At the start of my film, it's virtually impossible to relate to her. And yet I knew that my story had to start as it starts now in order to reach like a full transformation towards unconditional love at the end of it. And for us to earn somehow that love through a journey on understanding how love is born between two people who were not meant to love each other and who were just like living a lie at the start. And so knowing that I had to start with that, it was very like, it was, that's why I was talking about, you know, trying to find new ways to relate to characters. Because I thought if I can't relate to her on a like personal way, because she's what she is and what at the beginning she needs to be, meaning someone who is like deprived of emotions and deprived of humanity, and who is someone who has like a very, very, very hectic, chaotic way to relate to the outside world that is driven by death, basically. And I thought, well, I need my audience and myself to stay with her, to bear with her, and to understand what she's going through until the story, you know, morphs into something else. Until we get to, like, let's say, a more known space where, you know, emotions start to arise. And I think that two things helped me with that. I decided that we would relate to her through her body. That would be like the first thing is like it's really all about her bodily experience and the pain she inflicts upon herself through the whole beginning of my film. And that is something that for me, if it did not call for moral empathy, then it could call for like immediate bodily empathy, which means like when you see someone going through something painful, that your immediate reaction would be to, you know, kind of hurt the same way. So that was my entry point here. And the second thing that I managed to go through in order to write her was really anger. I think anger in her, let's say, feminine status in the beginning of the world that I create here. And this anger is something that I could relate because it comes from the fact that I think that the public space nowadays is not shared equally by men and women. Because women have to develop strategies the moment they get out of their home in order to anticipate on potential aggressions, okay? So this is something that revolts me very much. And I think that, I think a part of that anger I transferred to her. You know, the fact that I did not want to abide by this social law that women are targeting victims, that they have to be victims in the public space. And so that's why I created someone who was just like so devoid of emotion that she could actually, make her own laws, basically.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting the way that you describe it, because that is the way that I never even thought about it that way. That is the way we connect with her, with Alexa. It's the body, you know, because she looks like she's going through. I mean, she obviously is going through pain, but there's a sense of, I guess, reality and fantasy that kind of goes in with Titan. Like people question, like, what is real, what isn't? Did you keep it purposefully ambiguous in that way, or is it pretty straightforward and we're overthinking it?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, everything is real in the film, in the sense that this is the world I create and these are the rules of the world I create. So Everything I show you is something that happens, but I'm not saying that this is reality. It's just the world I create. But it's true that I'm trying to, most of the time, to stay clear of dream sequences. Like every time I have an idea for a dream sequence, I wonder why is it a dream? I mean, for me, it means that there is something that bothers me that I don't want to put on myself or something. And so you decide it's just a dream because it's a nice image and you still want to put it in your film because you think the image looks nice. But every time I think that, I'm like, no, if you like that image, you've got to make it work in order for it to be in the narrative and to have like a stake at this moment in order to make the narrative go forward. Because I do feel that for me, that's really my own opinion, is that dream sequences somehow make the narration go to a form of stagnation, you know, for a moment. And I think I'm not too keen on that. I'd rather like really say, okay, what do you really want to say with that image that you like so much? And, you know, find the ways to make it work in order to be the reality of your character at this moment. So so everything that for me in my film is real.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you. You are the, I know you've probably been asked this a thousand times, but I have to ask, you are the second woman to win the Palme d'Or, the first solo woman to win the Palme d'Or, but second woman overall to win that prize. And it's obviously it's a very long road coming. And I think you already spoke to, you know, the imbalance of men and women in life, but let alone in the movie industry. Obviously famously announced first at the top of the ceremony by Spike Lee, which is probably such a Spike Lee moment to have at Cannes. But can you take me back to that moment? Like, how did it feel, and how does it feel to have that distinction, you know, at such a young age in your career?
Well, there are two answers to that question. The first one is that, honestly, it's still a haze to me. I don't think it's something that I have fully processed yet. And I don't think that I want to process it, actually. Maybe in retrospect in many years. But right now, I do not want to yield under the weight of this too much, because I want to keep on working. And basically, for me, my next step is my next film and all that. And I'm very focused on that. I was obviously honored is really like an understatement. It's, again, it's like, it's the dream of any filmmaker, I think. And the fact that it happened when I was 37 was a bit putting myself, you know, it puts yourself off track a little bit, because obviously you never expect to receive it at such a young age. And it made me change somehow my sense of temporality as far as my career and my work are concerned. But also, I think that it's it raised the stakes very much, which is really good for me. I like that. I like the fact that my impulse was to see it as like this absolutely amazing turn of the story. But then how high can I go after that? You know, how higher I can go after that? This is really something that, that pushes me up. You know, it uplifts me. I think is that the word? It uplifts me very much. Yep. And I remember always, because it made me laugh so much, Steven Soderbergh's words when he received the Palme d'Or for Sex, Lies, and Videotapes. Mm-hmm. I believe he was 25 and it was his first feature. And he said something like, I think now I can only go down or something like that. It's very funny because it is something that you think about, obviously. This is like the something that at the same time you're so exhilarated and, you know, and happy and all that. And at the same time, you're very scared because like, I'm at the height of this mountain. So what do I do now? Do I go down or do I look, you know, for another higher mountain or something, you know? And he did reach way higher mountains than this. So he's a very good model for that.
Wow, that's awesome. You are representing the country of France at the Academy Awards to get a nomination for international feature. Women have not typically represented France, one of the stains of France. France is the only country that's submitted to the Academy Awards every single year since the category has existed. Mm-hmm. It's resulted in 65 submissions, 38 nominations, 9 wins. However, the last film directed by a woman to represent France was Mustang in 2015. There's only been 9 women in total in that entire 65-year span. You're lucky number 10 now, rounding out. What would it mean to you to represent the country at the Academy Awards, especially for a film such as this that's genre-defying? And, you know, completely reinvents something new for itself.
Well, for me, it is a big win, to be honest. I'm very, very proud that they chose my film to represent my country because, you know, in France, we don't have a huge culture of genre movies. A lot of people fight to make it happen. A lot of directors fight to make their films done, and producers as well. However, it's true that somehow it's been looked down on a little bit, this culture. Mm-hmm. It's not something that is installed like it is in the States, you know, not at all. So I must say that for me, the win is that I'm like, oh man, things are changing here a little bit. As far as genre films are concerned, things are changing. As far as this culture is concerned, things are changing. And I do hope that it is the beginning of something, but I believe so. I'm not saying that this is so new that it's just like in the past years, because like it's been decades that you've had people who really fought to find their way through our industry with genre films. But it's true that as far as other countries are concerned, they were not like well distributed. They were not very present in the landscape, just in the cinema landscape here. So this is for me like a very big deal, because it really means that somehow France is questioning and trying to also renew its own its own cinema. Mm-hmm. And so I think I'm happy, because I do intend to keep making films in France. And so it's a very good sign, like for me and many others.
But that was going to be my next question, you know, and Bong Joon-ho famously said once, because Americans, and I'm sure you know how difficult we can be, but foreign cinema, it's always a fight to get people to watch it here because of the subtitles. And Bong Joon-ho, famous director, Parasite, won Best Picture with Neon, who you're with as well, says once you get over that, you know, 1-inch text on your screen, you can enjoy so much more movie making. Do you ever have an intention or think about making English language film for like American audiences?
Not only American, like any English speaking audience, obviously as well. But
it was all air quoted. I was like, yeah, you know, just trying to keep it there. But yes, please.
No, I do. Yeah, no, I do want to. And especially, I mean, really, as far as like writing scripts is concerned, and obviously working with English speaking actors as well, but starting with a script that I could write in English, because like right now my English is pretty rusty, but if I stay in the US for like a week, it's way better.
You are not rusty. We're having a really good conversation. You're doing very, very well.
But I think that's something that interests me. You know why? Because I do believe that you don't write the same way and you don't write the same scenes, whether you write them in French or in English. I think that English is a way more action-driven language. So for me, it would be very interesting. I'm already very much action-driven. But so for me, it's like it's really a small step before I do that. But I do think that it would give out something different. And I want to tell you something that is very weird. I don't write many dialogues in French. Even Raw, which had substantially more dialogue than Titan, but still it was not a lot. I always say that I like to, on the page, I like to go as far as the action can go and as far as the image can talk and as far as the sound can talk. And then I see if I add dialogues or not, okay? I see if I can express things only with image and action, then I only express things like this. However, when I write dialogues, I think them in English, which is very weird. Like I've always wondered, but I think because honestly, the cinema that I'm mostly driven to is English speaking. So I think that's one of the first reasons, but also, I think that the English language is much more fictional than the French language, at least to me, obviously, because French is my language. Mm-hmm. It brings this instant fiction where you can say much more to me and with like less inhibition than in my own language. Like, for example, like things would sound cheesy to me in French, but not in English.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So to answer your question, yes, I will definitely direct them in English.
Yep. I remember, like, I can remember, there's very few movies I can remember exactly like where I was, what I was doing, like in any given moment. And I remember the moment I saw Titan. It was at the New York Film Festival. And I walked out, the movie was over. There's a little video clip I have of you online, like when you got the standing ovation in the room, and I walked out and I immediately, like, I was speaking to someone and I said, somewhere in the world during the pandemic, Julia was just making this movie. Like, just like somewhere we're all in the middle of a pandemic and Julia is just making Titan, no one bothering her. She's just doing this. Like, I had no idea. And at that moment, I had that conversation. Tom Quinn, head of Neon, walks out and I was like, listen, I don't know what you guys are going to do, but just do it. Like, do that same Parasite magic, do it with Titan. And I love that movies surprise us. That's what it is. I try to do my best to not know what a movie's about.
Yeah, I do the same.
I really try as hard to do that in my job. And I didn't know. And I was so glad. It was one of the best surprises. People are loving this movie and love your vision of it, but I also feel like they don't know you enough. So what was the movie growing up that did it for you? That was like, I'm in, I gotta go be a filmmaker.
Oh, okay. Well, It's hard to answer. It's like, it's not like one movie that made me want to become a director.
Yeah.
So the first thing is that when I decided that I wanted to do something with my life, it was writing. I was like, writing is my thing. And that's why the Pedro Almodóvar thing is really like, I'm happy because it brings me back to the source, you know, it's really nice. So yeah, it was writing. I've always written since I was a kid. I wrote stories since I learned how to write. And even before that, I was actually the one telling my parents bedside stories. Like I would invent them and they would actually follow them, fall asleep next to me.
So. That's amazing. I'm imagining like a little 8-year-old Julia just putting her kids, her parents to sleep.
Yeah, and that was very convenient to them too, because they were tired, they didn't want to read anything, so I would do the whole thing, you know, the whole show. But and so yeah, for me that was always like the first thing. But I've consistently watched a lot of films in my life because my parents are big cinephiles and that it was part of my education. Basically, they were like big, like authors that you have to read. And they were like big directors you have to see this film of, you know? And so I think like maybe the first time that I obviously did not say I want to be a director, but the first time I felt like a real, let's say a relationship with the film while watching it was when I was pretty young. I was 8 and it was with Cría Cuervos by Carlos Saura. Okay. And you know, at the time my parents showed us this film because there was this song in it that's called Porque Te Vas by Jeanette. That was very popular at the time, like very, very popular. And because of the song, my parents showed us the film in which the song, you know, became famous and all that. And I felt like, I don't know how to say that, but I felt so represented in that film. And I'm saying this, the character is 8, her name is Anna, and she can't cope with the loss of her mom. And she has to live with her father that she hates because he has a new woman, and her aunt, whom she hates as well. And because her aunt is somehow like trying to ground her to the realization of the death of her mom, and with her 2 sisters. And there is something in that film that is incredibly honest with what it is to be alone when you're a child, and how it's not all that pink, you know, it's not all fairy tales and cartoons and all that. And there is something very deep in it because the character is like a sponge. She's hypersensitive and she feels like very strongly the moods of adults that try to hide them, but she feels what's happening for real. And there is this whole thing with the mom as a ghost, who's played by Geraldine Chaplin, who comes back to talk to her, and they talk like watching the camera and all that. So it's a very unusual way to tell that story about a child. And I must say that after that, I felt so connected to that character that my parents bought me the little vinyl of Porque Te Vas. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to it like constantly with my little, you know, things where you would put vinyls in it. Yeah. And exactly the same way as the character does in the film. So I was like mimicking her as crazy. And this is the first time in my life that I felt how powerful a film could be and how much it could talk about yourself and it could make you feel less alone. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was speaking with Denzel Washington recently, who told me like, you know, you're in this business and you never know who you touch and who you're going to touch at some point. Yeah. And, you know, Carlos Saura, you know, all these people that probably have no idea what their movies have done for people.
Yeah.
It's very hard to like kind of deconstruct that. And then you look at yourself, you don't know what Titan or Raw is going to do for someone. Like, you know, I mean, I have a 10-year-old. I'm not gonna let her watch Titan yet. I will let her watch it. Just like, give her a little more time, but like, you don't know, like that, it could be the watering on the seed that makes it grow into a plant. Like you don't know what it can do.
I think that as a filmmaker, you kind of hope that you will touch at least one person, just because I think somehow you're trying to do the same thing that other films did to you. And you're trying to, bring your own share to this, you know, to try to give back a little bit. And I always, like, I know it's weird because I know my film, I'm not like the most accessible films in the world. But what I'm doing in there is trying to touch this very intimate place that no one ever talks about. And I personally hate unsaid business. I hate unsaid things. And I'm really trying to, I'm trying to make us commune over something that we would not talk to our friends or to our family or even to ourselves somehow. And I think that if I manage to do that and to touch one person who left something like buried inside and to relieve that person from that, even just for the time that they're just watching my film. I'm not talking about forever. I'm not talking about changing their lives. I'm just talking about this 1 hour and 40 minutes where they're watching my film. If they feel less alone with something, then I think that this is, that's the best thing that can happen. Like really, I'm really doing my films thinking of that very much.
That's director Julia Ducournau, the filmmaker behind Titan, which was released wide in October. And that's it for this edition of Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. Drew Griffith edited this episode, and Michael Schneider is the producer. Be sure to subscribe to the Award Circuit Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com and click on the Award Circuit tab to find the latest Oscar predictions and key races, as well as your daily fix of news, analysis, and reviews. For Jazz Tanke, Clayton Davis, and Janelle Riley, I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you on the circuit.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.